Mormon Discourse and Practice. Its author is Brian Cabarrus, who in addition to being an editorial assistant at Sunstone has also gone to school a little bit. He got his bachelor's degree in English at Brigham Young University, and he's currently working on a master's degree in the English department at the University of Utah in creative writing. The respondent will be Susan Staker, who is a PhD candidate in English at the University of Utah. Her dissertation will be on late 19th and early 20th century British novels. So they'll make their comments, and then perhaps we'll have some time for questions at the end.
Sorry that the microphone's not working better. I'm faint of voice as well as faint of heart, and so I hope we can get through this okay. Never done this before, and that means I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out. I think at a certain point, in addition to merely reading through my paper, I'm going to make a few ad lib remarks, and you'll be able to see when that kicks in, and if it doesn't, if you can't tell when that kicks in, all the better. But we'll get through this thing together, and I think it'll be interesting. Let me begin then. I'll read the title again and we'll just go for it. Escaping the Embrace, Idealization and the Hyper-Sacred in Mormon Discourse and Practice. The dividing of the sacred from the profane, the risen from the fallen, the eternal from the temporary constitutes one of the major projects of the religious tradition. Metaphysical religion teaches the believer to search for a God who dwells in a perfect ideal realm, a celestial kingdom which stands in opposition to the lone and dreary world. Consequently, believers most frequently find themselves worshiping or praying to or longing for that which is absent, for a perfection located somewhere beyond their human ken. In positing a God with a history, a God with body, parts, and passions, a human God, Mormon doctrine reacts against the grand division between the sacred and the profane. It invites a belief not so much in an immovable God as in a God who knocks at our door and steps forward to greet us, a God who gives himself over to us to embrace in a literal sense. Not surprisingly, however, the concept of a human God does not dispel all vestiges of ideality from Mormon thought or practice. On the contrary, Mormonism seems to be a quite fertile plot from which spring a host of idealizations. Idealization consists in the aggrandizing or overvaluing of an object to such an extent that the object no longer seems confrontable. In his now familiar paradigm, Freud points out how idealization can work within families. He suggests that the ego ideal or superego, which functions as a person's conscience, is really the internalization of the idealized father. According to Freud, the image of the idealized father inhabits a boy's or a man's mind as a constant reminder that no matter how well behaved he may be, he will continually fall short of living up to the father's expectations and must consequently live in fear of punishment. Thus, the little boy, little girls are practically written out of Freud's text, embarks on a lifelong quest to appease this disapproving father. Following after Freud, Jacques Lacan suggests that what the child idealizes is not so much the father's image as the father's language. Thanks. Lacan locates the conscience in the name of the father, in that body of language which sets the limits for how a child may comprehend itself, that word or those words which stand in for the father's body, to which a child feels a sense of responsibility. It is the discursive name of the father which teaches the child that to risk behavior which cannot be comprehended by the father's language is to risk the loss of paternal approval. It is to fail to live up to the father's good name. Setting aside the differences between Freud and Lacan, what remains consistent between the two is the idea that, as an overvaluing of an object, idealization, while paying tribute to an object, simultaneously serves to dismiss that same object. Freud and Lacan each perceive the idealization of the father as an incorporation of the father, as a boy's taking in of the father, as his way of having the figure of the father to be with him always. But insofar as idealization is a paying tribute, the boy internalizes the father at a price. The human being, once idealized and objectified, ceases to function as a living, changing person and begins to function instead as an ideal father. He becomes an object, an example, a symbol of perfection. Thus, argues Lacan, the symbol manifests itself, first of all, as the murder of the thing. And here's where I'm going to ad-lib just a little bit, and I'll only do it for a second. We think, well, what's so bad about being an example, or what's so bad about being a symbol? And what I want to suggest is, in this type of thought, To symbolize something is to strip it of whatever it is presently. Or Lacan talks about bodies in language in terms of a tesser or a coin. If you have a dollar bill, the dollar bill is valuable to us only insofar as it has a symbolic value. Nobody picks up the dollar bill and goes, how much is the paper worth? We think of it, well, how much gold does this represent? It always represents something that's way over there that we don't have access to. I don't have access to the gold, and we don't even believe in a gold standard anymore. So the piece of paper is worth something to me only insofar as it becomes symbolic of something else, insofar as it's an ideal. And as a piece of paper, per se, we don't even perceive it as that anymore. And in psychoanalytic thought, according to Jacques Lacan, or French structuralist anthropologists like Claude Lévi-Strauss, we do the same thing with bodies, that we'll have a body which is present the way that piece of paper, a dollar bill, is present. And to the extent that we turn it into an idealized thing, something with a symbolic value, we tend to forget that it's even a human body. It starts to play this role. In the very same way that the coin, by sheer virtue of the fact that it has a symbolic value, then becomes subject to exchange and a whole economy of money, bodies become subject to an economy of bodies to the extent that we forget their bodies and start exchanging them like coins. So I'll get back to that a little bit later, but that's the ad lib part. We made it through that okay. All right, I'll take a sip of this and we'll move on. Okay, paternal idealization, from this perspective, if not a literal murder, functions not so much as a form of embracing as a form of aggressively rejecting or driving away. In order to preserve the role, we cash in on the man, and this because of fear. It is according to this reasoning that Freud argues that we can understand how it is that the objects which men give most preference, their ideals, proceed from the same perceptions and experiences as the objects which they most abhor. As pertaining to the realm of the sacred, Freud suggests in his Totem and Taboo that feelings for a sacred object are superlatively ambivalent and indicate both hatred and love to an extravagant degree. The very act of treating an object as most holy implies an attendant amount of resentment and fear, once again a desire to thrust away rather than to embrace. The idealization of God consists in attributing to God the characteristics of a being radically departed from ordinary humans. In Freud's term, God himself becomes so far exalted above mankind that he can only be approached through the intermediary, the priest. Once such a situation arises, the need for a privileged caste which mediates between God and the rest of the community, religion becomes a struggle for power. Accordingly, Freud locates the moment of God's absolute idealization at the same time divine kings made their appearance in the social structure and introduced the patriarchal structure into the state. Banishing God from the world of the here and the now was the tribute patriarchal authority paid for identifying itself with the Father's uncontestable power. Of course, the idea that metaphysical religion might be a coercive political tool is, along with other dangerous notions, precisely the type of idea ruling ideology would want to hide. Within all communities, there exist concepts which, in order that the community might maintain the status quo, must remain untracted. In her book Critical Practice, Catherine Belzy suggests that at any given moment, the categories and laws of the established order are full of contradictions, ambiguities, and inconsistencies which function as a source of possible change. The role of ideology is to suppress these contradictions in the interest of the preservation of the existing social formation. But their presence ensures that it is always possible, with whatever difficulty, to identify them and to recognize ideology for what it is, and to take an active part in transforming it by producing new meanings. Later, in referring to the literary world, Belzy states that when, as a defense against such change, criticism attempts smoothing out contradiction and closing the text, criticism becomes the accomplice of ideology. Having created a canon of acceptable text, criticism then provides them with acceptable interpretations and thus effectively censoring any element in them which come into collision with the dominant ideology. With this understanding arises the understanding that a religious congregation might possibly create a canon of acceptable scriptures and doctrines, provide them with acceptable interpretations, and effectively censor any elements within them which came into collision with the dominant practice. Belzy does remain careful to acknowledge, after Louis Althusser, that such censoring by the ruling ideology reflects in no sense a set of deliberate distortions foisted upon the helpless by the corrupt and cynical. If there are groups of sinister men in shirt sleeves purveying illusions to the public, these are not the real makers of ideology. Ideology has no creators in that sense, since it exists necessarily. Still, What must be recognized is that in order to prevent the surfacing of embarrassing and possibly disruptive questions and practices, ideology employs certain strategies to hide away those issues it would rather not confront. One of the most common strategies is idealization. As an example of what Nietzsche in On the Genealogy of Morals calls active forgetfulness, idealization might then be seen as a form of repression. According to Freud, the essence of repression lies simply in turning something away, in keeping it at a distance, away from consciousness. Such also seems the case with idealization, that overvaluation which distances and thus functions as a turning away. Freud delineates between two stages in repression. The initial stage, primal repression, consists of an individual's denying himself, out of fear or prohibition, the possibility of fulfilling a particular desire or admitting into consciousness a particular impression. This desire or impression is forcefully pushed out of consciousness, and as a result, a fixation is established. In order for this repressed primal desire to somehow surface, the initial desire migrates to related objects or impressions that stand in for the object of primary fixation. Repression proper occurs when the unconscious begins to deny the conscious access not just to the object of original fixation, but also access to the associated objects of desire. In a continuing effort to grant to the repressed individual some type of assuagement, the unconscious repeats this associative process until eventually a displaced desire sets upon an object sufficiently removed from the primary fixation for the desire to be fulfilled without fear of punishment. Thus, in repression, desire is fulfilled metaphorically or, as it were, by proxy. In other words, you can't have one thing, so you have another. Okay. The primary function of this turning away, however, is to deny repeatedly the individual access to the original object of fixation. Consequently, the entire network of desire structures itself around a central object placed under erasure. That object of fixation, which the subject simultaneously most desires and most fears to embrace, is precisely that which must remain repressed and which must never be spoken. Yet in the very attempt to force the object of fixation into perpetual silence, the object only becomes increasingly reified as the very center of the individual's psychic life. Now, if we apply this notion of repression to a community, those ideas which, out of fear, the community must repress, where might they be located? As in the case of the individual, at the community's unspoken center. If Mormonism wanted to push an object away from itself, or keep an idea out of circulation, some questionable or disruptive doctrine or practice, how would Mormonism dispose of it? Perhaps not simply, as one might imagine, by equating that concept or practice or the secular world and subsequently thrusting that object outside of Mormonism's borders, but perhaps instead by idealizing the dangerous, so that in some cases those precise things which threaten established Mormonism the most are the same things which Mormonism guards within its very heart. Perhaps just as this conspiratorial epistle in Poe's The Purloined Letter escapes detection by the police by dint of being excessively obvious, the letter was left on the center of the suspect's mantelpiece, so Mormonism displays its most dangerous doctrines at the center of its bookshelf or between the covers of the Sunday school manual. What Mormonism wishes to hide, it labels transcendent, eternal, ideal, or sacred, and so, it hopes, will end all discussion. As I have said, Mormonism, in a number of areas, has provided sites at which the notion of an idealized, completely foreign, metaphysical God can be challenged. Some of the most notable examples lie in the depiction and explanation of the nature of God in the endowment ceremony, particularly before the most recent revisions. Nevertheless, a great many vestiges of the traditional metaphysical God persist in Mormon doctrine, popular thought, and popular practice. In continuing, however, I want to concentrate not so much on the persistence in Mormon thought of an idealized God the Father as on other possible occurrences of idealization in Mormonism. My intent is not to unveil within Mormonism a grand conspiracy aimed at duping the herd, but instead to suggest that Mormons, like virtually everyone else, idealize. And when they do, it is quite often a reflection, as I hope to have demonstrated, of an unwitting attempt to hide something from themselves or to push something out of their lives, something that sparks an anxiety within insofar as it suggests a need for revision or heralds inevitable change. Although the limited size of this paper and my limited observational abilities deny the possibility of a complete discussion of all the kinds of idealization of Mormon discourse and practice, let me outline at least a few possibilities. Earlier I mentioned how the idealization of the Father, according to psychoanalytic thought, leads to a loss of the person. Mormon culture seems very much to participate in this type of idealizing. Clearly, this phenomenon is not unique to Mormonism. Freud speaks of the idealized father as a transcultural construct, and Freud most likely knew little or nothing of the new American church. Still, fathers, as patriarchs in Mormon culture, bear the burden not only of being examples to their children in secular matters, but also in spiritual matters. According to Mormon thought, no success outside the home can compensate for failure within the home. And so the father is under considerable pressure to be an ideal father, since the salvation of his entire family, as well as his own salvation, depends upon it. For an understanding of what it means to be a success, the father may turn to priesthood manuals or other institutionally manufactured texts, all of which present themselves as a kind of script or role into which the man must insert himself in order to succeed. Inevitably, however, the man fails to live up to the paradigm. One hears talk of fathers who are better than average, or even the best. But where are the fathers who are better than the manual, who are celebrated because they outshine the paradigms? It seems in Mormon culture, fathers, like movies, are never as good as the book. And if Mormons tend to prefer the book, is it because Mormons constantly idealize the originary, the source from whence springs a host of derivations doomed to be labeled untrue? The possibility of a father falling short of the book is only possible to the extent one considers the role originary and the man himself a derivative. The thought suggests that more than embracing the man himself, we embrace the role he is expected to play. That before relinquishing the latter, the role, we would sooner part with the former, the man, that we would mortgage a human being to cling to a fiction. Women, perhaps even to a greater extent than men, fall victim to idealization and are mortgaged in exchange for an illusion. If women, as we are told, not just in manuals, but in hallways, classrooms, and from behind the pulpit, are innately more spiritual than men, how can we hope to perceive the woman who questions, who doubts, who exercises a critical eye? If women, as we are instructed, are naturally more nurturing and less sexually aggressive than men, what happens to the woman who fails to conform to such paradigms? Do we relinquish or modify the paradigm, or do we simply discredit the women? When we reject the woman who does not conform to the categories of acceptable behavior, we declare that the categories and the roles ascribed to womanhood are more important than the woman herself. Only metaphorically can we embrace a category, and yet Mormonism continues to attempt a metaphorical embrace of the intangible categories of womanhood and motherhood more than it literally embraces the present and living bodies of Mormon women themselves. Here I'm going to ad-lib just a little bit more. Talked about how money has an exchange value only insofar as it's symbolic. This is what happens with women's bodies, according to French structuralist anthropology. The woman functions as the coin, which must have a symbolic value in order to circulate in the community. And the second that we start asking, well, this quarter that I'm showing you, I mean, how much is the metal worth? Then, like, it doesn't work as a quarter anymore. It's got to function symbolically. And so same thing can tend to happen with people in the society, and I think particularly women. The second that we want to exchange women's bodies symbolically, then we have to stop looking at them as individuals. We can't see the body that's there. We have to read them only as ideals. And again, that idealization is what allows us to keep circulating bodies as if they were money. Okay, enough of that. Back to the paper. Mormonism purports to be the true religion, which most advances the concept of a living God, a God with a body of flesh and bone as tangible as man's. Yet for all of Mormonism's talk of a God who is literally an approachable father, Mormonism expends precious little energy in approaching God the Mother. Yes, Mormonism will always admit that there is a mother in heaven. The concept of her existence is too firmly established in Mormon doctrine to be denied now. But the doctrine makes the orthodoxy uncomfortable. If a woman can be a god or a goddess, might she not be equal in power to a man? Established thought must do something to counter this type of notion, lest women begin to reject subservient roles and demand first a voice and then authority within the church. Established thought must silence talk of a heavenly mother. Thus, in a move more subtle than directly stating the woman's glory, no matter how great, always falls short of the man's, established thought does just the reverse and aggrandizes the glory and the holiness of the woman to an extreme. The mother in heaven, then, becomes so pure and so holy that we debased creatures are not even worthy of knowing her name, let alone anything of her attributes or her history. All we can do, if we even dare to, is intuit who she may be based on what we know to be true about the male, a strategy that breeds theories like Freud's, theories that, as useful as they may be, speak almost nowhere specifically about women and eventually deign to label the category of woman simply as a dark continent. To understand the woman only through the man seems a project bound to lead to a metaphysics like Freud's, in which women are viewed ultimately as failed men. By perceiving a Heavenly Mother as a being so sacred we dare not speak of her, we ostensibly pay her tribute, but at the same price we pay when we label any ideal image over the actual body it wants to represent. Instead of bringing the tangible body closer to us, we actually drive it away. Is placing the Mother in Heaven on a pedestal any different from the Victorians placing their women on a pedestal in an ostensible tribute, which altogether smacks of their keeping their delicate china out of reach so it wouldn't be broken? Mormonism, insofar as it removes her to a silent metaphysical realm, treats the Mother God not so differently from how the American New Criticism treated the poem. The New Criticism, according to Jane Tompkins, functions as a culmination of the deification of poetry which began in the 19th century. According to critics such as William Wimsatt, the poem, in short, was a sacrosanct object whose autonomy demanded a proper respect. It stood self-contained in a metaphysical realm. From this was born the notion of the heresy of the paraphrase, the idea that to translate the poem to any equivalent was to violate it. The most appropriate response to a poem was to admire it in perfect silence, a reverencing quite akin to Mormonism's silence regarding the Mother God. Mormonism's sheltering of the Mother God recalls the New Criticism's sheltering of the poem insofar as, according to Terry Eagleton, it declares the poem must be plucked free from the wreckage of history and hoisted into a sublime place above it. As the New Criticism reduces the poem to what Wimsatt calls a verbal icon, traditional Mormonism, so quick to reject the graven images in Eastern churches, similarly reduces the Mother God to an icon, an idealized and lifeless representation of a woman in a heavenly realm, the object of our detached and disinterested contemplation. Jane Tompkins suggests that such enclaving idealization holds the icon in a stasis through the implication that if the poem were to break out of its self-containment and perform a service, this would disqualify it immediately from consideration as a work of art. The first requirement of a work of art is that it should do nothing. So it is with the Mother God in Mormonism. She must remain unspoken and consigned to a world beyond ours so that, like the new critical poem, she can do nothing. In Against Interpretation, Susan Sontag suggests that we interpret a poem when, for some reason, it has become acceptable, yet it cannot be discarded. Interpretation is a radical strategy for conserving an old text, which is thought too precious to repudiate, so we revamp it. The interpreter, without actually erasing or rewriting the text, is altering it, but he can't admit to doing this. Idealization, or hyper-sanctification, whether admitted or not, functions in Mormonism as just this kind of interpretation. Mormonism finds concepts such as the Mother in Heaven disruptive, yet it can't discard so precious a doctrine. Thus, Mormonism interprets the Mother in Heaven as being too holy to approach, and all conversation of her is effectively silenced. The doctrine of a Mother in Heaven is an element in the Mormon problematic which, for whatever reason, became unacceptable. By interpreting the Mother in Heaven as on a pedestal, Mormonism's established order locates a potential danger within a controlled setting, and at the same time provides an example of how, for Nietzsche, becoming master always involves a fresh interpretation, an adaption through which any previous meaning and purpose are necessarily obscured or even obliterated. Precisely because of such moves to secure or retain power, Sontag refers to interpretation in certain cultural contexts as reactionary, impertinent, cowardly, stifling. And when Sontag goes on to call interpretation, or assigning to a text an absolute or transcendent meaning, the revenge of the intellect upon art, why should we not believe that when religion idealizes, it is a revenge of orthodoxy upon growth? Probably the most obvious idealized aspect of Mormon culture is the temple. The temple is origin of doctrine, and the one place Mormonism's saving ordinances can be performed stands at the very center of the religion. Yet, as in repression, that thing which stands at the center of our lives becomes so overwhelmingly sacred we must not speak of it. Should members have questions about the temple, instead of being granted audience with an expert or encouraged to speak with friends, they are asked to attend again and again with the idea that time and repetition will bring a higher understanding. Any explanations of how one might read the endowment ceremony generally consist of tautologies such as the temple's just sacred, or romantic equations between truth and beauty. Temple-goers soon learn that any talk of the temple is limited to nods and smiles, and thus, as articulated in Roland Barthes' essay, Power and Cool, we regain the ideality of a world surrendered to a completely gestural vocabulary, a world which will no longer slow down under the fetters of language. Like gangsters, gods do not speak. They nod, and everything is fulfilled. Our silence pays ostensible tribute to God's house, but how often do our nods and smiles, instead of betokening a profound understanding which transcends language, become one way of excusing ourselves for having nothing to say? Wouldn't we, on occasion, be more honest if instead of nodding and smiling, we just shrugged our shoulders? Or an appeal to pedestrian wisdom. What might the story of the emperor's new clothes teach us about the need to ask questions about the temple? Not that there is a right way to read the temple, not that the ceremony needs any normative meaning, but our obsessive need to keep the temple text outside of all circulation, and this one, documented history in early Mormon architecture, suggests temple concepts and language once played a much greater part in public discourse. Might this not intimate that on some level we simply don't want to confront the ceremony, that it could possibly teach us things we would rather not know, or that, even more disconcerting to the traditional mind, it might defy our attempts to understand it? By interpreting the temple as so overwhelmingly sacred we cannot ever speak of it, do we create another verbal icon which by its very nature can do nothing, and so choose to remain comfortable and refuse to confront a text which simply baffles us? Talk of the temple leads us to talk of garments. We don't talk about them much either, except on laundry days. I think the missionaries refer to them as whites as opposed to colors. Anyway, we know they are sacred and meant to shroud our bodies day and night. The idea is garment should be as inseparable from body as body should be inseparable from spirit. But how often in our attempts to honor the garment do we make a mistake similar to worshiping the gold in the temple more than the temple which makes the gold sacred? Does the body adorn the garment or the garment adorn the body? To what extent does our idealized zeal for the garment teach us to feel ashamed of the flesh? It was not God that taught us to feel ashamed at the sight of our flesh. If we wish to continue to view ourselves as the church of the living God, we must not give up our belief in the gifts of the Spirit. They always follow true believers. But where are they, and why do we not see them more often? We do not see them because we have idealized them. When we can't surrender our belief in spiritual gifts, and yet evidence would suggest that we, in our churches of brick, aren't speaking in tongues and causing the lame to walk like the congregations in the whitewashed churches, we must idealize miracles. Suddenly we hear allusions to experiences too sacred to relate. And we then rest assured that if we never see the workings of mighty miracles in the Mormon church, this only confirms more fully that the miracles in our church are more sacred and more miraculous than the miracles performed in the whitewashed churches. As with miracles, Mormons also hyper-sanctify Scripture in an attempt to avoid any confrontation with the Word. We idealize the King James translation to the extent that any other translations stand out like halter tops in the chapel, and they receive about as much approval. But if we perceive the King James Version, or if we privilege the King James Version over other translations to the degree we won't even open another translation, we blind ourselves to the weaknesses and virtues inherent in all translations, since such strengths and weaknesses can be seen only through comparison. And by considering the Book of Mormon so plain and so true that it needs no explication, by considering that its chapters and verses so perfect they virtually speak for themselves without needing us to give them voice, do we not convert studying the Scriptures into simply reciting the Scriptures? Is not even the slightest attempt at explicating the Scriptures met in Sunday school with requests to get back to the truth of the text itself? It seems the only time we accept any kind of declarative scriptural explication is when it comes either from the lesson manual or from Nibley, both of which have already gathered about themselves a certain institutionalized authority and idealized status. Other aspects of the gospel we fear confronting we idealize not simply by locating them in the realm of the sacred, but also by locating them safely in the realm of a mythical past or a glorious future. Such seems the case with polygamy. Like the concept of a mother in heaven, the doctrine of polygamy is too tied to Mormon history to be forsaken. And yet how many are actually willing to live it? Polygamy subsequently must be declared a higher law, a law we are not presently worthy to bear. So we wait for polygamy, that vestige of our epic past, to be reinstated when God deems us worthy, and we rest assured that whenever that day may be, it will arrive after our lifetimes. We similarly idealize the law of consecration as a doctrine too precious to refute, too axial to be considered a doctrinal fibrillation. It must be located with polygamy in our pioneer past and in our perpetually suspended future. Because everyone wants to confess a belief in consecration, but how many are actually willing to live it now? As long as we can idealize consecration as one other perfection for which we are not yet ready, to believe in the law of consecration will never mean actually living the law of consecration. It will only mean planning to live it. I might go on to mention other possible examples of idealization in the way we perceive Third World and especially Latin American converts as children, and how we idealize our leaders, and how we refer to the learning disabled as already saved, as if our concern for them ended there, and how we idealize sexuality, or how we consider chastity or any of the commandments as written in heaven instead of written in our bodies and descriptions of how we manage them in the world. The greatest and therefore the most invisible example of idealization, however, is the idealization of the entire gospel. We idealize and consequently remove from us the gospel when we repeat the maxim, the gospel is simple. The plan of salvation is explained in together, there may exist the possibility of living the gospel. But where there are bodies, there are necessarily interests, desires, contradictions, differences. The gospel necessarily becomes difficult to live because living is necessarily difficult. One says the gospel is simple in theory, but I suggest that theory is inextricable from practice, and that living the gospel, although it may be possible, perhaps we can only flicker in and out of living the gospel, will never be simple. To call the gospel simple is to attempt to disengage ourselves from others, to assume that only our view is true and close the books, to cease asking questions, to cease finding answers. When we do this, the gospel becomes dead to us. In critiquing idealization, I don't call for a world or a religion devoid of all mystery, because mystery will always erupt on its own. How many times has science thought it had discovered or invented everything? Each time it was wrong. Language, and thus our understanding, insofar as articulated by language, will always contain gaps. Each time we explain a mystery, a host of new mysteries rush to take its place. There is no need to fear exhausting the mysteries. We need to confront our idealizations because they are built of fear and a desire to thrust away. And God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And behind each repressive act of idealization lies a desire which, out of fear, we refuse to act upon. While a sizable number of contemporary thinkers, and many not so contemporary thinkers, search diligently for the idealizations within particular ideologies in order to locate their weak points and uncover the lies upon which they are founded, it seems something more can be learned from examining the idealizations within a religion. As much as encountering an idealization may represent an opportunity for self-deception within a religious community, that same idealization may also point to the possibility of better understanding the desires of that community. Indeed, we may not want consecration or polygamy, but perhaps behind the idealization of these doctrines lies a desire to redefine our community. We may idealize Scripture to the point of no longer being able to learn from it, but perhaps behind this idealization is the desire for a God who still speaks or whose word is still valid. We may idealize the concept of a mother in heaven or women in general, but couldn't that fear to confront them allude to a much repressed primary desire to embrace women or bodies in general as something other than objects? Couldn't it suggest that our greatest fear is to acknowledge our inescapable dependence and desire for the other? That, as Martin Buber suggests, the longing for relation is primary, as is the cupped hand into which the being that confronts us nestles. Ideals teach not merely the supposed truths which are openly declared by a community, but also the desires which, though often repressed and unspoken, drive and establish relationships between the bodies which comprise the community. If there is a gospel to be found, it will not be located in a paradigm or some idealized heavenly realm, but here and now in our desire to live one with another. Thank you.
I have to say that I very much liked Brian's paper, and I'm not going to quibble at all. I agree heartily with his analysis of the way institutions and individuals can deploy the sacred, the important, as a cover, a protection, which hides precisely because it seems to display and to honor and to elevate. I'm intrigued by a suggestion that those things which we declare most sacred, most thoroughly beyond language and history, can function as signs or pointers to mark the spot of that which most troubles us and potentially subverts the status quo. I would also underscore, as Brian has done, that such covering is not the result of bad faith, of conspiracy to do harm. Use of the term ideology, which Brian adopts after Belsey and Althusser, to describe alignments and commitments implicitly embedded in the function of institutions, can sometimes confuse the issue because of our common language usage of the term. He is too ideological, we say, or that's only ideology. Ideology has come to mean in this context something like impractical or fanatical theory, but certainly ideas consciously held. In the technical sense Brian is using, the term ideology is not so much a matter of consciousness and choice, but rather of history and social constraint. The hallmark of ideology, in this more technical sense, is its invisibility. The way in which the invested commitments it licenses and maintains seem self-evident, natural, a matter of common sense. And Brian is adding that within the context of metaphysical religion, ideology is made invisible under cover of the sacred, the transcendent, the important. What I want to focus on for the few minutes I have is the question of what to do given the problem Brian outlines. The trick is obviously to find strategies for uncovering the heretofore invisible workings of ideology. For as Brian has pointed out, at any given moment, the categories and laws of the established order are full of contradictions, ambiguities, and inconsistencies which can function as a source of possible change. It is in the details, then, in the trivial, in the unimportant, the marginal, that we might find a source of knowledge and power for this productive change. What we need, then, are strategies for reading in detail, or, I might say in our context here, what we need, then, is a theology of the detail. Reading in Detail is the title of a book by Naomi Shore, who charts a sort of archaeology or history of the detail, the rises and falls in its reputation from neoclassical times when the particular was censored in favor of the general, to what she sees as a contemporary postmodern, quote, privileging of the detail, or the pervasive valorization of the minute, the partial, and the marginal in interpretive strategies. We live in an age when the detail enjoys a rare prominence, she writes. Her book asserts what she calls, quote, the detail's claim to aesthetic dignity and epistemological prestige in the service of effeminist hermeneutics. But I would say we have good Mormon precedents for attending to the detail, to what might, to many religious minds, seem trivial. Recently, I was typing into my computer for Signature Books, my employer, sermons and articles written by Orson Pratt for one of the books in our series, Essentials in Mormon Thought. My mind was wandering, as it often does when I'm typing, but it was brought up suddenly when I realized I was in the midst of an extended discussion of vegetable preexistence and vegetable resurrection. I attended with growing fascination, and sometimes what I must admit edged near to horror, as Orson worked his way through a discussion of particles and also a careful calculation of how long it would take to people a world if a god had only one wife and spiritual pregnancy was approximately the same length as early pregnancy. And I can't remember. He had it all figured out in terms of like the number of years and how it would take. A thought, I must admit, was quite horrific. And I might also add that Orson calculated no resting period between these nine-month pregnancies. I knew particles were important because in working with Wilford Woodruff's journals, I had learned that a major contention between Orson Pratt and Brigham Young revolved over their respective theories of particles. But as I thought about this energetic pursuit of theology in the details, I realized that it was precisely such readings in detail, that it was with such readings in detail that Joseph Smith leveraged some of the most subversive and innovative contributions of Mormonism. In attending to the disjunctions between the details of the two accounts in Genesis, he was led to describe a distinction between the spiritual creation and the physical creation. He was led to consider the plurality of gods. It was in meditating on the details which had remained in the margins of traditional Christian thought then that Joseph Smith found the openings for his revelation. And of course the precedent goes back even further, for it is in the New Testament we read of God's attention and concern for the detail, as in, "For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." I am not innocent in recommending this reading in detail, because I believe with Shore and other feminist critics who have recommended various versions of this attention to what has been declared by the guardians of the status quo as marginal, unimportant, trivial, in our context here perhaps declared profane or indecent or inappropriate. I believe that in reading in detail, we come finally to attend to problems of gender, which otherwise remain conveniently out of view. Shore, in her Archaeology of the Detail, points out that women in Western culture have always been associated with the detail, with the particular, with the physical exigencies of nature, mostly because of her ties to childbearing and childrearing and to the body. She writes, "The association of details, femininity, and decadence is perhaps the persistent legacy left to us by classicism. The association of terms points again to the potential for subversion." We can find a good example of what happens if one follows a program of reading in detail if we return to Brian's example, Freud. Freud, Brian tells us, attends to the problem of the father, and thus little girls are practically written out of Freud's text. They are, for him, the dark continent. Though I would probably have to agree with the final assertion, I would want to qualify the first. For in his final years, the late 1920s and early 1930s, Freud turned increasingly to trying to solve the problem of women in his theories. Freud, as you will recall, had enthroned reading in detail at the center of his methodology, his short-sighted, narrow, and finicky work, he called it. His primary principle of reading, of course, is free association. And what that means is you look at every detail, you assume it's meaningful, and you follow it down this path that it leads you. And if you just keep following where this detail leads you, it will finally lead you to the repression, to what bothers you, what the problem was in the first place. The study of Freud is immensely complicated because of the way in which he continually returns to his own earlier work, picks up on details in the margin of the earlier argument, and leads himself into repeated revisions of his own argument. Thus, for example, in his late work, Inhibition, Symptoms, and Anxiety, Freud returns to his description of the weakness of the ego in relation to the id and superego, which had been the focus of his recently completed work, The Ego and the Id, and describes this time instead the power and the strength of the ego. And in fact, this work is very interesting because in it, Freud considers a number of major revisions to his theories. One theory, quite strikingly, if you know anything at all about Freud, which he considers revising in this book, is the centrality of castration. He asks, furthermore, is it absolutely certain that fear of castration is the only motive force of repression or defense? If we think of neuroses in women, we are bound to doubt it. Women make him doubt. Trying to figure out how his Oedipal struggle works out in the case of the little girl is a very difficult task for him. For little girls who have no penis to castrate, it's hard to come up with a reason why this would become the central focus of their life. And in this work, he admits that it might be slightly secondary, somewhere down the line in their thinking, and that separation from the mother, for example, might be the more central problem to consider. And feminists have continued to press at the inconvenient details women present to other theories comfortably propped on a universal or a human model, which on closer examination turns out to be a male model. The female body is not characterized upon first glance or first touch, as Freud seemed to think, by an inferior penis, the clitoris, but rather, if you look at it, by a multiplicity of sexual organs, the vulva, the breasts, the clitoris, the vagina. And feminists have used this figure of what we actually find when we see and touch and pay attention to the female body as a model for the possibility of difference, of a different story that must be made to make an accounting of contradictions teased out whenever we insist on the strategy of reading in detail, speaking in detail. So it is a theology of details, then, a theology of the jot and tittle, if you will, which I recommend as a response to the sacred about which we shouldn't speak. In doing so, we open up the possibilities of change and follow in an important Mormon tradition. I can cope with the notion of the vegetable resurrection. Plants, I sometimes refer to people. But I don't think we finished the discussion of how long it would take one woman to people a world. Thank you.
Questions? Right. So the question is how do we believe in Christ without idealizing him and making him insignificant?
Can we talk about Christ and
Satan? Let's see how we can respond to that. I haven't addressed. You want me to speak right into the mic? Thanks, Lynn. I didn't deal specifically too much with Christ because when I speak of God coming from the metaphysical tradition, I guess I'm led back to the idea of the Trinity and that, you know, Christ and the Father end up being the same person and not the same person, but they dissolve one into another. And at least Christ is a metaphysical being the way he's been handed to me, you know, I didn't know who he was, you know. And all the stories that I was taught as a child, which tended to show Christ as a human being, as someone that, you know, embraced the children. I mean, in their simplicity, I think they offered us a really good example of how, you know, we can embrace Christ and, you know, worship him and love him as a human being. The problem I have is when Christ turns into the Pantocrator that you often see associated with, you know, medieval theology, where, you know, Christ is that harsh judge which condemns people to hell. When Christ condemns someone to hell according to that type of thinking, I think, you know, it's done from the metaphysical stance in which God's at the center of the universe, and if he were to reach out towards us, he would be dislocating himself from that center, and, you know, and therefore he'll never do that. And, you know, I mean, I see Christ, you know, having a body, being tied to the body on a variety of occasions. We see him eating and drinking. I mean, he seems to be very human to me. And, you know, to worship somebody and to idealize them, I think they can push toward the same thing, and yet I don't think they need to be the same thing. I mean, worship can mean love. We've associated the word worship with meaning, you know, to thrust aside or to push into, you know, an inaccessible realm, but I don't think that needs to be the case. I mean, the very fact that, you know, God came to earth and that, you know, he touched people and healed them with that touch, I don't find that to be metaphysical at all.
Can I comment? I think that Christ and Christianity does become a real problem for feminists. I mean, people talk about that a lot. And I know I think of my own experience growing up, being very touched by the notion of Christ, identifying with Christ, and I don't know how long it took me to figure out that I couldn't really identify with Christ because he was a man and I was a woman. And one of the things that I admit is a big problem for me in trying to imagine where I stand in a religion is having a religion where I have to be saved by a male. You know, where do I stand to think about, you know, what my place is then? You know, and I think it is... That isn't something we usually talk about, but I find that really a problem for myself.
I just want to say one thing, and then I think there's a question in the back we'll get to. I'm not really qualified to speak on women's issues, and I think I've done it too much already today, and yet one thing I did want to say is the fact that Susan here mentions identifying with Christ, and it seems to me, insofar as identification, at least in the Freudian sense, it leads to an incorporation and an idealization, which is exactly what at least we're trying to get away from. It seems, and, you know, they're going to hate me for this, but it could possibly be advantageous for the woman worshiper or follower of Christ insofar as that she can't identify with Christ. Christ doesn't become that idealized figure insofar as the woman can't incorporate him. She can't relate 100%, so Christ always presents himself as other to her. I don't think that the way we've seen women's bodies deployed within Mormon culture or, you know, Christian culture would necessarily suggest that, you know, women have been emancipated because of that thought, and yet the very possibility that women can't incorporate the image of Christ in the same way men can could lead to the possibility that women wouldn't feel that need to identify completely with him that they wouldn't feel the need to identify with Christ to the extent that he becomes the idealized father, the superego for them. Is that a problem?
Yeah, no, I think it is true. In a way, what I'm saying is that it does, for me, create a distance, which then makes me question. So, but in a way, I see it as a good thing in the sense that it helps uncover these sort of invisible things we don't think about, but I am left with a big problem,
right,
which is a religion that says to be saved, I have to go through this man, you
mm-hmm.
know, and that, you know, is a problem.
Yes. That's possible, and yet I think it leads to, you know, befuddlement of the kind that I talked about. I think one thing that we can learn, you know, about the temple ceremony, to the extent that we talk about it, I'm not saying that we need to, you know, like, publish it, you know, for public access anywhere, but, you know, there are places where we can talk about it. We just talk about it because nobody else is. But, you know, you can talk about it in appropriate places. And to the extent that we begin to talk about it, what we're going to find, you know, it's the same thing we find with, you know, a poem that we talk about. You can never get to the bottom of it, that it just keeps going. And to the extent that, you know, the temple functions as this abyss in which we, you know, are constantly, you know, struggling to understand it all and yet failing to do that, I mean, it leads us to, you know, a greater understanding. I think the thing that we learn most from the temple is just how to read and how to be charitable. I mean, it gives us a text which, you know, I mean, there are hermeneutics available to teach us how to read it, and yet hopefully it would defy them like other texts.
I'd also just say that to say that the notion of silence can be deployed in counterproductive ways doesn't mean that silence is bad. I mean, obviously, there are places where it's wonderful and appropriate, and the thing you would most want is to have people quit talking and just, you know. So, I mean, part of it is just to say, to look at the way things that we do value and that are good and wonderful things can be deployed in ways that are counterproductive, and that we can't just let things be declared off limits to us by stamping them with this seal that says you can't do it. You know, your question's always got to be why this seal, you know, and it can sometimes be a good thing, but sometimes it can be, like Brian said, a sort of sign that something's going on here we might want to look more closely at.
What has happened?
Right.
You know what I'd say, though, to that is that there are not many of us who have the self-image of the prophet. You know, we're not ready to go out and break the institution. But, you know, it's easy to step onto this little treadmill that Freud opens up, which is just like, look at this one little thing that's just sitting there, but don't let go of it. Just, like, follow it where it takes you. And what he says is where it takes you is a really scary place, you know. And you're sort of empowered as you go through that kind of a trail in a way that, you know, you're never likely to just start out to say, you know, I am a subverter, you know. But the other way, it works real well.
She's referring to that loose thread which, if pulled gradually and delicately enough and long enough, will eventually unravel the entire business suit.
Okay, this session's over. If you have any questions, just come up and ask.